Well, hello everybody. Hello and welcome to Essex Church, where this community of Kensington Unitarians meets for worship each and every Sunday of the year. This is public worship. By law, our church door must remain open, unlocked. Enshrined in law is the right of each and every person to join us here. How important then is it that we extend a warm welcome to all who join us? Visitors, friends, newcomers, all are welcomed as part of this community. And let's extend our welcome this morning to all those who might be listening to this service as a podcast sometime in the future. You might be in Wakefield or York, Seattle or New York. We hope that this service will be of service to you sometime in the future, and that the extremely heavy rain that we're experiencing in London at this moment has passed, and that your fields are green. We hope too that our essential message gets through, the message that we are all part of something greater than ourselves, and that we are welcome here in life and here at Essex Church, just as we are. Whoever we are, wherever we are from, however we are feeling today, here we can belong. And I'm also extending a warm welcome today to my friend and colleague, the Reverend Joy Croft from Norwich, who is joining me in leading our worship here today. So as I often do, I invite you now to take a conscious breath. And use that breath as you will, perhaps to calm and center ourselves in the here and now. We can breathe in a sense of belonging, and perhaps breathe out anything that we feel ready to let go of. Some weariness, perhaps, or anxiety. That long list of things that we really ought to be doing, maybe. Or that slightly raggedy feeling that can come from a long journey across London on a Sunday morning. We are here now together. And I light our chalice flame, this symbol of our worldwide Unitarian and Unitarian Universalist community. And I welcome three unseen guests to join us here. Faith, hope, and love, that we might find space in our hearts for those three. We've changed the order of service round today. And so now we move into two brief stories, both featuring the holy fool of Sufism, Mullah Nasruddin. The first comes from his childhood and reminds us that sometimes a person who is suffering just wants us to listen to them. They're not seeking our good advice. When he was a child, Mullah Nasruddin fell down the stairs and hurt himself quite badly, as you can do falling down the stairs. And despite all the ointments and potions that he used, that pain made him suffer terribly. So his friends went to comfort him. "Oh, it could have been worse," said one of them. "Well, yes, after all, you didn't break anything," said another. "You'll get better soon," intervened a third friend. And at the height of his pain, however, Mullah Nasruddin screamed at all his so-called friends, "Leave all of you. Get out of this room immediately. And Mum, don't let anybody else in, unless it's someone who has fallen down the stairs themselves." You can't imagine how pleased I was when I found another story about Nasruddin continuing to fall down the stairs in later life. But this one's called The Mullah's Overcoat. He was going downstairs from the elevated garden terrace at his house where he'd just awoken from a nap. And Nasruddin, as we sometimes do, missed a step and fell down the stairs. "What happened to you?" asked his wife upon hearing the clatter of his fall from where she was in the kitchen. "Oh, nothing at all," replied Nasruddin, getting up with some difficulty. "My overcoat My overcoat fell on the stairs. Your coat? Well, then what was all that racket? The racket was because I was inside the coat at the time. Two stories of falling downstairs. So would you join me now in a time of prayer and reflection? As I call on the Spirit of life and love to be with us now and to bless all that we do and say together here this day. As we look back over the week that has passed, we might be aware of times when we fell short in some way, when we allowed ourselves to be perhaps diminished in some way by harsh thoughts or words, by failing to act perhaps, or by acting too hastily. Let us think kindly of ourselves. We may be aware of the failings of others. We may have been let down in some way, or hurt, or even harmed. May we find within ourselves the gracious gift of acceptance of what is, or forgiveness even if it is the time to do so. We may have been frightened or angered or frustrated by life. May the gentle flowing waters of the Spirit allow us to let go of that which is ready to be released. And may the light of understanding shine upon our situations in life so that we might better understand what is required of us at this time. Let's share a moment of quiet now, a time in which, if we wish, we can send our own thoughts and prayers to individual people or places in our wider world or within ourselves, places where we know love is needed, perhaps where there is little chance of flying freely in life. So may we live this day, compassionate of heart, clear in word, gracious in awareness, courageous in thought, generous in love, in touch with the wisdom of the Spirit that will help us always along this path of life. Amen.
I have to tell you that when Sarah and I, as you do almost annually, prepare a service together, one of the important things that we have to wrestle with is finding the right height for things, because there's a certain difference here. It's lovely to be among you today and to share one of my great loves with you, although I didn't expect it to be that, because I started telling stories, I suppose about 10 years ago, in a kind of desperation, when my eyesight took a turn for the worst and I badly needed to find a way to conduct worship, to speak publicly without any notes, and stories are an awful lot easier to remember. But I soon discovered how much I love the fun of telling them, and also what wealth there is to be found in stories, because stories touch our hearts, and some of the most memorable stories have been told and retold through history because of the insights they give us, however fanciful they are, into how we lead our real lives. And that can be true even when a story isn't deep, apparently, but really is quite fun. Not, mind you, that this story I'm going to tell you can be classed as fun. This is a story of deep terror and of great, great courage, because it takes place in a land long ago and far away where the countryside was being ravaged by a terrible beast, the most dreadful beast that's ever been known in the whole history of life. The beast had four eyes and six legs and 1,000 teeth. And he roamed the countryside, seeking whom he might devour. In the morning, he would grab and gobble up men on their way to work in the fields. In the afternoons, he would burst into isolated cottages and eat up mothers and children as they were sitting down for their lunch. And in the evenings, he would roam the streets of the cities, seeking whom he might devour for his supper. Now, in the biggest city, the capital city of the kingdom, there was a pastry cook's, the best pastry cook's in all the land, in fact, pastry cook to the king by royal appointment. And the pastry cook and his wife had a small son named Sam who helped in the shop. And one day Sam was helping out as he always did. You know how people come and go in a bakery and they're sharing gossip. And he heard that the mayor of the city had offered a reward of 10 bags of gold to anyone who could capture and conquer the beast and save the city. And Sam said, "Oh, wouldn't I just love to win those 10 bags of gold?" But his father said, "Oh, don't be ridiculous. Go and put those cakes in the oven." And then later in that same day, more people came into the bakery, and Sam heard someone say that the king of all the land had offered a reward of 100 bags of gold to anyone who could rid the kingdom of the beast. And Sam said, "Oh, wouldn't I just love to win those 100 bags of gold?" But his father said, "Don't be ridiculous. You're much too small. Go and take those cakes to the palace for the royal tea party." So Sam did as he was told. He balanced the tray of cakes on his head and he set out through the city. But he was so taken up with thinking about winning all those bags of gold and what the family could do with them that he lost his way. And only as the evening was beginning to draw in did he realize that he wasn't sure where he was going. And he went up one street and down the next and he just couldn't find his way. And he knew it was time to head for home because the sky was getting darker all the time and the beast would soon be on the prowl. But he just couldn't find his way. And it really was quite dark now and the streets were pretty much deserted because everyone was hiding inside their houses with the doors locked and bolted for fear of the beast. And Sam ran up one flight of steps and knocked on the door and then on another and said, "Please let me in or the beast will get me." But people wouldn't open the door because they were afraid they might be devoured by the beast as well. And at last he could hear, first of all, a sound like thunder coming from the outskirts of the city, and he knew the beast was coming. And then he heard a dreadful roar and he turned and looked, and there at the end of the street was the dreadful beast itself, and there was nowhere to go. And Sam, in his terror, dropped the tray of cakes and scuttled under the flight of steps and hid there as the beast came nearer and nearer. And then the beast stopped right in front of that flight of steps, and the beast opened his terrible jaws with 1,000 teeth, and with a sound like snack, the beast devoured all the cakes. And then, when the cakes were gone, the beast turned on Sam. Sam summoned up all his courage, and he called out, "No, no, no, please don't eat me, oh beast. Wouldn't you rather have some more cakes?" And the beast stopped, and he looked back at the empty tray, and he said, "Yes, they were very good cakes. I particularly liked the ones with pink icing. But there aren't any more cakes, so I'll have to eat you instead." And he reached in, and with his great clawed foot, he grabbed and dragged Sam out. But Sam was as brave as he could be. After all, his life was at stake. And he said, "No, no, please don't do that. If you spare my life, I'll make you more cakes. I'll make you no end of good things, because my parents are the best pastry chefs in all the land." "Said the beast, "will you make me some more pink ones? Oh, I'll make you as many pink ones as you could eat, said Sam. So the beast, having a little power for reflection and reconsidering, said, all right. And he whipped Sam into his pocket and he went off and took Sam back to his lair. And the beast lived in a dreadful, dark, looming cave, and the floor was scattered with the bones of those he had eaten. And he shut the door and he kept Sam there, and Sam went on baking cakes for him, as many as he could. And when he ran out of anything, like flour or eggs or whatever, the beast would go lumbering back into town and get him whatever he needed for his baking. Although I have to tell you, the beast never paid for any of it. And he brought back the ingredients, and Sam went on, and he made, oh my goodness, he made eclairs, and he made scones, and he made sponge cakes, and he made donuts, and he set them all out before the beast. But the beast looked at them, and he said, you haven't made me any pink ones. But Sam said, just a minute now. And he whipped up some pink icing, and he put pink icing on every single cake. And then he said to the beast, right, they're all pink now. And the pink ate them up, and loved them. And as the days and the weeks went on, the beast grew so fond of Sam's cakes that he stopped eating people. And Sam went on baking. And so it went on until very early one morning, and the sun was just beginning to rise. Sam was awakened by a terrible sound. The beast was groaning in pain and writhing and rolling on the floor. And I don't know if you can guess what the problem was, but Sam did quite quickly, and he said, oh, beast, it's those pink iced cakes. You've got the toothache. And the toothache got worse and worse because the beast still couldn't give up those pink iced cakes until it got so bad that even though he was a prisoner, Sam's heart was touched and he said, right, now I'll sort this out for you. Sit very still and open your mouth as wide as you can. And Sam went and got a pair of pliers and he pulled out every one of those 1,000 teeth. And of course, once he pulled out all 1,000 aching teeth, the beast couldn't eat people anymore. So Sam took the beast back to the city, and Sam collected the 10 bags of gold from the mayor as his reward, and he collected the 100 bags of gold from the king as his reward. But his family, although they were now still very rich, still loved baking. So they went on baking cakes, and the beast had to have something to do, so the beast helped them in the shop. And every day in the afternoon, the beast would take the cakes to the palace for the royal tea party. And along the way, all the citizens would stop and say hello to the beast, and they'd even pet him. And quite quickly, they forgot altogether that they'd ever been frightened of the beast with the 1,000 teeth. Now, you are deep thinkers and experienced people, so I don't need to tell you that the moral of this story is that if you just have the courage, there are always new experiences that you might be able to take use of, even in the most frightening and daunting situations, and new things you can do if you just think creatively about them. So I'm going to invite you now just to think a little bit about how that might be true now and in the future, in your own lives. I'm just going to ask you to think for a minute, and I'll give you just about a minute of quiet to think about each of these, how you have been, how you might be more open-minded, more open-hearted, more open to the Spirit. So once again, just take a moment to still and center yourself. As you breathe in, be aware of being here and now. As you breathe out, breathe away anything that might distract or worry you. Just be here in this moment, here and now. And may we be, in the days to come, more open-minded, remembering now sometime in the past when we have found ourselves open to some new idea, to some new way of thinking, to some new way of living in the world. Let us open our minds now and in the future. And let us ask to be more open-hearted in the days ahead. Remembering, looking back to the past and remembering a time when we may have been surprised by love. Love for someone we hadn't loved. Love for someone we might not even have met. Where we found ourselves more open-hearted to new work, to new causes, let us ask to be more open-hearted now and in the future. And let us ask to be open to the Spirit in the days to come. Remembering times in the past of our lives when we've been surprised by joy, warmed and strengthened even by sorrow, enlightened by some experience that came to us quite unexpectedly, enlarging our vision. Let us ask to be more open to the Spirit in the days to come.
The spiritual practice of story sharing. We all have our stories. We have polite, small talk stories that we share during coffee hour after Sunday service. We have half-truth stories and stories that we wish were true. We have family stories and personal stories, happy stories and sad stories, unbelievable stories and ordinary stories, work stories, love stories, and faith stories. We have stories we hide and pretend aren't there, and stories we hold close to our hearts. And we have stories that we share. Many of us are hesitant to share our stories, especially stories of our faith journey. We think that our story lacks originality because it doesn't have the flair or intrigue that other stories have. Our story might be messy and confusing, tied up with any number of other strands in our lives. Our families, our culture, our heritage, maybe even our political and social attitudes. Or we might be ashamed of our stories, unresolved with their grittiness. So we hide from them, tuck them away, and pretend they aren't there. But when we share our stories, we begin to connect on a deeper level with ourselves, our spirituality, our loved ones, our communities, and our congregation. Because sharing our stories isn't just a recounting of events, but a spiritual practice. No one said story sharing is easy, and in today's technological age, there is an increasing need to protect our stories and preserve some level of privacy. We need to be careful about how, when, and with whom we share our stories. But when our stories are told with truth and kindness to people who genuinely respect and care about us, we create an opportunity for meaningful connections, and the process can be liberating, healing, and spiritually enlightening as well.
Thank you, Niall. When I read the blog that Niall's reading comes from recently, it reminded me that a spiritual community like ours can be a place where we share our stories. At our best here, I think we do create a safe space for deep sharing. And of course, deep sharing requires skills of deep listening. And here we get to practice those skills too. It's in the telling of the stories of our lives that we create our Kensington Unitarians community. These are not simply the stories that touch our lives, significant though they are. The stories, I think, are our lives. They are the fabric of our very existence. And in their telling to others, and in their being truly heard, we continue to create ourselves throughout our lives. Now, this continuing act of creation of ourselves gives us endless opportunities, if we choose to take them, to examine the stories we tell. We might hear ourselves and others getting stuck in certain stories about who we are. We know, don't we, most of us, how some life patterns can keep repeating themselves on and on and on. Some of my negative ones at the moment are: I'm so messy. I am no good at filing or gardening. Why do I find it so hard to finish anything? I wonder if any immediately ring bells with you, or you want to fill in the dots of your own repeating negative stories. Life, then, I think, can be an interesting dance between acceptance of ourselves just as we are and the counterbalancing ability to shift that story along, to clamber out of the ruts of thinking that say, "Oh, I'll always be like this." And I know I've been listened to well when my story is in some way mirrored back to me. And the possibility both for transformation and acceptance are there. This is how it is. This is how it might be. I've been reading some of the work of Catholic theologian Karl Rahner recently. He describes the mysticism of everyday life and suggests that all moments and experiences can be potentially revelatory. For Rahner, God is ever present, even in the most mundane or most difficult of circumstances. He encourages us to pay attention to the smallest details, as well as to the overarching narratives of our lives. Our stories, they're precious. They are both unique and universal. They identify us as the individuals we are, and they connect us one with another in a shared experience of being alive, of being human, of a shared human consciousness. I invite us all to consider our lives as sacred texts, as stories to be told, to be honoured, and to be appreciated, each and every one of them. I think I've got time, yeah, just to mention two listening projects that have been developed in recent years, one here in the UK, one over in the States. Both these projects give people a chance to record a conversation with someone who's important to them. One's called the Listening Project, and these conversations can be heard on Radio 4, and each one will be kept by the British Library forever and ever. And over in the States, the StoryCorps project provides booths in which people can interview someone significant to them and record their story. Their website gives access to every single one of these conversations. Some 57,000 of them have been recorded since the StoryCorps project began in 2003. And also on their website, you can watch animations of some of these stories. One that I watched yesterday graphically told of the experiences of Alex, an African-American young man whose understanding of colour changed when driving his car, aged 19. He was pulled over by the police and beaten up so severely he nearly died. There is something about hearing a true story like that that helps me understand an existence that is a long way from mine. And I think here at Essex Church, here we have our own listening project each week as we light our candles of joy and concern, and we invite some people to tell us who or what they light their candle for. Ask people about the issues of their close to their hearts. And we often say, don't we, that although we get to hear only a few stories each week, yet over the years, this ritual of candles of joy and concern builds up our understanding of what it is to be human. Perhaps we can then understand one another a little better. Perhaps our own issues are put into perspective. And perhaps we understand the sacred task in which we bear witness to the lives of others. For as author Isaac Dinesen writes, to be a person is to have a story to tell. Each of us has a story to tell. Our unique life experiences that shape who we are. In the week ahead, let us be the storytellers of our lives, revealing a little more of who we truly are. And let us be good listeners to the stories of others, honouring their life paths by our loving attention. Amen. Go well and blessed be.